Good morning, 7:40 on a Wednesday, and that means it is time for our chat with the fine folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District, and joining us, we have Wendy Powell and James Coover in studio. How are you both doing today?
Pretty good.
Good to have you. So we're going to start out first with Wendy. I know what a chilly morning. I mean, we had to scrape our cars off and everything, to get in here, because I got out the door, I was like, oh, great. You know, I'm like, this is another 5 minutes easy. Just scrape this whole thing off.
I kind of forgot that that's a whole thing we have to do.
I know, it's terrible.
Winter is here.
It's terrible. I'm like, someday if I ever have a garage, but I'm like, now I got to spray that stuff on and be proactive. Thankfully, I did put the de-icer stuff in my windshield washer. That's a lifesaver.
It's a good idea.
But yeah, so... We're talking some calving and keeping the cattle warm and everything, it's kind of chilly.
So that's a big deal right now. Before I jump into that,
sure.
We've got just a few events coming up on our event calendar on our website. ServSafe Food Manager Training in Parsons on the 22nd this month, and then Holiday Happenings in Independence. That's November 18th. And coming up December 20th is Choose Health, Food, Fun, and Fitness. And we've got a Master Food Volunteer online training coming up in January also. So lots of fun things coming up there.
Excellent. Very good.
Yeah, so you mentioned calving. We're pretty well done with fall calving, but it's never too early to start thinking about those spring events and what needs to be in the feed truck with you whenever you're out checking calving herds and making for sure that they're all ready to go. So some of the things that might be handy to keep around, paper and a pen. That's always good too. Paper and a couple pens or a pencil maybe to jot down the dates and cow number whenever they do calve. That way you can keep track of that throughout the year. That's going to really help with the productivity of your herd, the profitability. If you're able to keep track of which cows have calved, then you know which ones haven't, and you know which ones are really sucking down your grocery bill. Something else to keep on hand is a tagger and some tags to make for sure you're marking those calves when they do hit the ground. It's much easier to tag a one-day-old calf than a two-month-old. James, do you have any experience with that?
Considerably, yeah.
Yeah, it's not as fun.
Yeah, it sounds like you have a little story there.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So something else to keep in there, assistance tools or at least a plan in each pasture. If you're coming up on a cow or a heifer that is calving, know when to start lending assistance, know what condition each stage is of the parturition process. And speaking of that, we have a calving school coming up on January 12th. So that'll be a good opportunity for folks to learn about the process. We've got this really fancy demonstration cow that will come into the room with us, and it's not a live cow. So don't worry, no poop to clean up. So this cow will actually have all of the parts where you can see it, and then we have screens with cameras so you can see throughout the audience and the process of the calf coming through the birth canal and how all of that happens. And then Dr. AJ Tarpoff will be talking about the different things that can go wrong and how you can fix those problems. So that calving school is January 12th in Fredonia.
Nice. I think I've seen a similar setup they have in your building at the state fair.
Yes.
The kind of demo and everything.
Yeah, that might be the same
might
cow.
Be. I mean, I can't imagine, how many of those are floating around.
Right. So whenever you have a plan for when a cow's having problems, then you're more likely to be able to save that calf and the cow. So each pasture is different. Some pastures have handling facilities handy. Others don't. So you need to know what you're going to do. If you're going to roll up into a pasture and find a problem, are you going to... go to the house and get a trailer? Are you going to call a vet to come out to the pasture? What's your plan? Just having that plan is super great.
And also warming blankets you mentioned on here.
Yes.
That sounds so cute.
Yeah. So a heated blanket, anything that can plug in. Whenever we have calves hit the ground that just aren't thriving, And we can talk a little bit about why that might be, but it's really important to get those critters warmed up. And if you can get them warmed up within 2 hours of them getting on the ground, then you're going to be a lot more successful raising that calf. So you can do that by putting them in the floorboard of the pickup, a warming blanket, you know, those plug-in heater, floor heaters, anything like that will help, you know, take them in the house and put them in the bathtub, anything like that to get those critters warmed up. Even like warm water immersion. That sounds like a really wet, yucky process with a newborn, but you know, that's a thing. So any of those methods, just have a plan. Even if you don't think you'll run into it, just have that in the back of your mind that it could be a problem. So there's a lot of reasons that we could have unthrifty calves. And the big one right now, because we don't have much green grass and the cows haven't been grazing green grass in a while, is vitamin A. So this is like a really major vitamin that our animals need to have healthy gestations and have healthy newborns, and that goes across all species. So if calves start hitting the ground and they're just kind of not getting up, or their ears aren't forward, they're not looking for the udder or anything like that, then those are just unthrifty calves and they have a lower chance of survival. They're not getting that colostrum that they need, all the things. The cows might even be weaker, even go down, and that's certainly not what we want. So that vitamin A is super important. It is abundant in green grass, so it's usually not a summer problem. But this year, it probably was, and it will only be stored in a cow's liver for 2 to 4 months.
Oh.
So we're kind of getting in that period of they're already out right now. And then whenever we supply a mineral, like free choice mineral in the pasture, excuse me, then that vitamin A that's in that mineral is still disappearing. And when it's mixed with a trace, it's disappearing at 10% per month.
Oh.
So whatever the feed label says on there, that is probably not what is actually being available to the cow to eat. So I'd love to chat more with folks on that. It's a very complicated process, because whenever vitamin A is by itself, it doesn't disappear as quickly. But whenever you mix it with all the things we mix it with commercially, it disappears so much faster. Mm. So definitely keep an eye on that. If you have a few cows that start calving and you see a problem, there is some solutions. So you just need to work with your vet to make that happen. And then the other thing for thrifty calves is to make for sure that our cows are in the right body condition. So we really need cows at a body condition of 5 to 6 for calving. And cows under that, more thinner cows that you can see their ribs on, body condition 4 and down, those cows are not going to have as high quality colostrum. And we know what colostrum is. That's the liquid gold that makes life go around. And there's no real substitute for that. There is commercial colostrum. It's not as good as what a cow can supply to their calf. So it's really important that those cows are in good condition so that they can have excellent colostrum supplied to those calves. So lots of different aspects of the calving season that we get to look forward to. And if we think about it now, then we can have a more successful season.
Sure. It's just one of those things you want to be prepared and just kind of have your toolkit ready. That way, you know, when you need it, you don't have to drive an hour back, half an hour back, whatever, to go get it, those items. Because, you know, it sounds like kind of a critical time, really, as we get into that.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we talk about this every time you're on, I think.
Yes.
Hay supplies.
Yes, it seems like it's getting to be really old. So something that we're all worried about, my operation included, is hay supplies. And so I was visiting with a few different folks, and we were just talking strategies on how to make everything stretch. So one thing that's easy to do that only costs money is checking how you hay. How do you put out each bale of hay? Do you unroll it in the pasture, you know, to provide a nice warm bed for everybody to lay in and poop in and pee in, and then they don't eat it? That's like a 20% waste of your hay bale. And while it does have a purpose with like newborn calves, because they need that warm spot, it certainly doesn't need to be happening right now with herds that don't have newborns on the ground. So that's one way to definitely keep more hay available for eating. And then the type of feeder that you use, just the regular circle hay feeders that don't have a skirt. And a skirt's just like this piece of sheet metal on the lower foot and a half of the hay bale feeder. And that keeps the hay in there.
Yeah.
So a cow will take a bite, and if you could see my hands, you would understand better, but I'm sorry about you. They take a bite, and then they take a step back with that mouthful of hay, and hay will just fall down to the ground, and then they take a step forward to take another bite, and they step on what they lost. So that's like a 15% waste right there. So they have these cone feeders and modified cone feeders, and it's really hard to describe. I was trying last night and I failed miserably, so I'm not even going to try. I'm just going to encourage you to give me a call or look that up online. Cone feeding hay rings. Those are what the hay bales will sit down inside, and there's a cone that the cows can come in on the side from, and then they take a bite and it falls down still in the hay feeder.
Okay.
And so everything stays all up in the hay feeder, and so those are more like a 4% waste.
Oh, nice.
So if you're just doing the math, if you've got X number of bales in the hay pen and you're just really monitoring how that hay is being fed, you can really stretch that just by changing the feeding process.
Sure. I always think it's really funny when the calves are small enough and they crawl in the feeders.
Yes.
And then they're just like laying in there eating, and I'm just like, what the heck?
Yep, those are the special little calves, yep, aren't they? Yeah. So those, definitely keep an eye on how you're putting the hay out. The other few things that you can do to stretch your supplies that you already have is cull any open cows. If that cow's not going to be producing, this is a business, and sometimes it's a hard decision. It's still a business. So you got to cut those losses. So do some preg checking, call your open cows, call any attitude problems, cows that don't milk as heavily or they don't raise as productive of the calf, things like that. And then to go back to the feeding hay, only put out one bale at a time. I know it's really handy whenever you work off the farm to put out two or three bales at a time, even in a bale feeder. That way you don't have to do it as often. But that skyrockets your waste percentage.
Yeah, I've seen some real messes with that.
Yeah. So it's amazing how much can be saved just by giving only what is needed at a time.
Sure. Is there any sort of a rule of thumb as to like how many, like if you're kind of looking ahead to winter, like how many bales per cow for planning ahead purposes?
Yeah, that is a great question that I actually get pretty often. And it all boils down to the quality of the hay that it is and what you're feeding with it, if you are feeding with it. So if you're offering a grain mix or anything like that along with the bale of hay, then that will factor in. Of course, the bale of hay will last longer. So each gestation phase of the cow has different requirements for protein and energy, and we have to make sure we meet those. So all of the corn stalks that I've seen samples come back on, they're not quite enough energy or protein to meet a cow's needs. So they need to be supplemented. So that bale might last a little bit longer than, say, a bale of alfalfa, where a bale of alfalfa supplies all of the needs. So it all boils down to the quality of the hay.
The other thing, question I have is, you know, you see these hay barns and sometimes you kind of watch the year and it seems like some of those bales have been in there a while. How long is a bale going to last? Does it lose nutritional value?
Absolutely. That's a great question. Thank you. So anytime a bale is stored outside, the weathering process will degrade the grass that's in that bale. So anytime when you see rows of hay, the round bales in a row, you want to have those north-south because that's how the wind blows, and that will keep the driving rain more on the north end than on the south end. And you don't want those bales curved side to curved side. So I see that pretty often simply because it's easier to back into the first bale and squeeze the flat ends and take off through the pasture. Well, that curve right there where that V is, that is where all of the snow is going to accumulate. And all of that snow sitting there melting, that's going to degrade those outer layers of that bale. And so that bale is going to lose quality so fast. Now, whenever we see bales stored in a barn or under a tarp, that is going to last a whole lot longer because it's not getting the moisture. So certainly, that's another way to stretch your hay that you currently have is just protect it.
Sure. No, that's a great tip for sure. I really appreciate that. All right. So anything else you'd like to add on this as we wrap up this segment?
Yeah, I just want to mention that calving school again, January 12th. It'll be in Fredonia. It's going to be an evening program. The flyer will be out for that next week. But if you have any questions, go ahead and give me a call. And you can reach me at the Altamont office, 620-784-5337.
All right. Well, Wendy Powell, thank you. Of course, coming up in our next segment, we have James Coover talking some apple trees. So we will return here in moments on the Mighty 690 KGGF, 30 degrees right now in Coffeyville. 8:11 here on the Mighty 690. We continue our chat with folks from K-State Research and Extension. Wendy Powell and James Coover is here to talk some apple trees. We've been talking trees over the break, yeah. You know, aspens and locusts and all that sort of thing. So, but hey, apples are very much near and dear to my heart. I've already eaten one this morning and I have another one in my bag. So I'm like a apple fiend.
Yeah, they're pretty much, you know, the classic fruit, honestly. And
right?
So, you know.
And see, and I love them because, you know, you never, I'm always with a peach or something. It's like a little window where you can eat it.
Yes.
Or like bananas are even worse. It's just like, oh, you get an hour of ripeness and now it's too gone.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even bother with those.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I mean, I know normally I'm talking about crops and soils and all that, but yeah, people love apple trees.
They
do. I want to talk about something different today.
Yeah. Yeah. So, let's see if Jesse is okay with
yes,
this.
Yes. I did confirm with him when I wrote the article. I wrote an article about trees last month. I confirmed with him that it was okay. So
okay.
If you do have farther questions about apple trees, you should probably ask him, though.
Yeah.
I would say, you know, we're talking about apple trees, and I don't know, I just sort of dived into the oddness of them, honestly, and did some research. There's some weirdness to them. And so apple trees, they actually came from Kazakhstan, which was, you know, South Russia,
yeah.
Pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Is where those trees came from. And they actually started as something similar to crab apples. And over, you know, a very long period, farmers eventually got them to the apples that we know today. But those crab apples that they started with are very similar to the crab apples that we have here.
Which are native, right?
Which are native. Mm-hmm. And so they're crab apples that are native to the United States, and there's some that are native to Asia and you know, Europe and all that. So there's crab apples all across the Northern Hemisphere, and all of them could have been made into apples, but those were the only farmers that did it. So it's just odd that we, one of those things. All apples, though, crab apple or domestic apple, they all belong to the same family, the Malus family. And you know that. And so they can all go back and forth, too, because they're all in the same family. And so types of crab apples native to the U.S. Are native. We have a prairie crab apple, and we also have a sweet crab apple. Sweet, they're not actually sweet. And so crab apples are very bitter. You can technically eat a few of them, but if you eat very many of them, they're gonna make your stomach sour.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they're too bitter, they're too astringent. I wouldn't suggest it. Of course, there are ways that you can make jam
cooking
and stuff out of them.
Yeah,
you can do stuff with them, but that's like a lot of our fruits, really, you know, our native fruits.
Yeah, sand plums, for instance.
Exactly, yeah, in that same category. So, you know, we have, you know, they're not very big, pretty crab apples. Like, our natives aren't huge, beautiful things. But, yeah, we can actually plant those natives around here,
sure.
too. So, you know, and like I was talking about, they're all genetically the same family, right? And so all apple trees, they can cross-pollinate, which means, you know, because those flowers are different, every seed is genetically different.
Hmm.
So it's more similar to pigweed or something like that, where there's like male and female, everything gets mixed together. Their genetics are wonky, pretty much, is what I'm trying to say. And so no domestic apples come from an apple seed.
Really?
You cannot plant an apple seed from an apple. You will end up with an apple tree. You have no idea what that apple tree will be. It will
That's
not
awesome.
Be the same. So every Fuji apple that you've ever eaten, what came from the grafting of another Fuji apple tree, which all came from the original Fuji apple tree, wherever that was created. And so that means that every Fuji apple that you ever eat is genetically identical to every other Fuji apple.
It's like the armadillos.
Yes.
Genetically identical.
Yeah, there's four of them that are genetically identical. Yes. And so, I mean, it would be fun to plant a seed and see what kind of tree you get, except, you know, that's a 10-year process.
So that's what Johnny Appleseed was doing, was just planting seeds, and it was just kind
of
whatever.
So, yes and no. So the story of Johnny Appleseed isn't quite right. Well, they talk about him just going along and throwing out apple seeds, all that. He was actually more of a botanist, and so he didn't just randomly throw out seeds. He knew about this genetic thing, and so he actually did a lot of cross-pollinations.
Okay.
He actually did a lot of grafting, and he, you know, took some European varieties and mixed it with other varieties, and so he was actually culturing apples. He wasn't just throwing apples out there,
know.
But he did actually start a fair bit of apple orchards and all that.
We actually, in my family, in Ohio, they have, at one point on a family farm, they still did have some Johnny Appleseed trees.
Yeah, there you go.
Cool. They didn't produce much anymore, but they were still there.
Yeah. And so, I don't know. It's odd how stories get going, but if he just would have thrown out apple seeds everywhere, there would just be some random crab apples all over the place, and you never know.
When I throw an apple core out the window, that's what I'm doing.
There you go. Who knows what we'll turn into? And so, you know, pretty much, yeah, everything is going to be a little bit different.
Sure.
When we're looking at apple trees to buy, we're normally looking at standard, dwarf, semi-dwarf. I mean, those terms are usually familiar because that's what we know them to be. The tops and bottoms of trees are actually different in nearly all apple trees. And so the reason is because everything is grafted. And so the tops of the trees, the live part basically, we call them the scions, is the part that you actually graft onto the tree. It's onto different rootstocks. And so the bottom of the tree and the top of the tree is different. The rootstock is actually what decides the size of the tree. And so you can graft any kind of variety to apple onto a rootstock.
Hmm.
And it's that rootstock that will decide that. There's not a different variety that's a dwarf Fuji versus a full-size Fuji. It's the rootstock that decides
that. That's fantastic. That's so cool.
And so, you know, there's about a dozen different types of commercialized rootstocks. And although those rootstocks, and they got like names like QR7 or something like that. Yeah, it's nothing that makes sense to us. But if you actually look on the tags of those apple trees, like the horticulture store, you can sometimes see that rootstock. It's the rootstock that will decide the size of the tree. But usually homeowners are going to buy basically the semi-dwarfs. Commercially speaking, the vast majority of orchards, they go with the semi-dwarf, and they probably are going to choose a little bit farther on in the rootstock exactly what size they're getting. Homeowners don't normally do that.
Yeah, because I would think if you're especially wanting to pick apples, you don't want to have to rent a cherry picker to go up.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Because standard trees, standard means the rootstock is full size. I mean, like almost like you planted an apple seed. And so, you know, those can get up to 40 feet tall. That's a huge tree. Mm-hmm. You can't get up 40 feet tall. You know, they can actually, the bigger the rootstock, the longer the tree. And so a standard apple tree can live 70 years. There's some in England that have been there for over 100 years. And, you know, they can take when you plant it, it takes longer to fruit too. It can take 7 to 8 years. Even, you know, when you've bought a yearling or 2 yearling long, it still takes 7 to 8 years to fruit on a standard tree. That's why most people go with semi-dwarf. They usually get between 15 to 30 feet tall, depending on the amount of semi-dwarfness it has. And they can live to 30 to 40 years. And they usually fruit after 4 to 6 years. So that's more practical for a majority of homeowners. More practical for commercial operations. So that's why semi-dwarf is by far the most common. However, there's also dwarf. And those are kind of like for people's yards or maybe under power lines or just, you can actually put some of these into pots. And so you can have a potted apple tree.
Fantastic.
Yeah, they're like cute little things, honestly. Like, you know, sometimes you see them. I mean, it's full-size apples, but it's just a tiny little baby
tree.
That's
wonderful.
And so, you know, the smallest ones are 5 feet tall. And so, I mean, you could literally reach over the top of the smallest trees. They don't live that long. I mean, maybe 15 to 20 years, which is still a long time, right? I mean, they'll fruit really fast, too, after 3 to 4 years. I will say that the smaller the tree, the weaker the rootstock. That's actually how they that's actually how they're done. That rootstock is actually weaker, and that's how it makes a smaller tree. So you have to be careful with them a little more. You know, you can't let them, they're not as drought resistant. Probably got to fertilize them a little more. Usually not a big issue in commercial operations or around your yard. But if you're going to plant it out, you know, into nature, a big tree's going to do a lot better.
Sure. Now, what about these ones that we see in the seed catalogs that they're like five different types of apples on one tree?
Yes.
What's with those?
All that was a rootstock, you know, a trunk with a bunch of branches. They cut off the branches and they grafted different apples onto one tree.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I mean, you could do that in your own yard if you wanted to. I mean, if you had a tree out there, an apple tree of some kind, you could graft on various different kinds of apples.
Sure.
So onto it.
So which ones are best for homeowners?
So, I mean, like I was saying before, the semi-dwarfs are best. Anything above 15 feet is too high. You can't take care of it. That's why most operations, you know, you've seen the orchards, they actually have machines that go about 15 feet tall and they just cut everything off. No matter it is, they just, it's like a, I don't know, a
like
trimmer.
A big hedge trimmer.
It's a big hedge trimmer. That's actually almost exactly what it looks like. And they just cut everything off. And the same thing with your homeowners, because they send up a bunch of whips. And, like, all those whips aren't very productive on apple trees. Pruning an apple tree is, it's a science, you know, and it takes a long time.
Well, it's like tomatoes. You're supposed to pull off those suckers and everything for better production, you know. Yeah. I've never bothered to do it, but, you know, you're
exactly
supposed to.
That's the thing. It's like over time, you get less and less bothered to do it. Yeah. So if it's going to be under in your front yard or under a power line, for instance, go with a dwarf or a very small semi-dwarf. I mean, obviously, power lines are about 15 feet tall. And so you don't want your apple tree up in them. Otherwise, the utility is going to come along and they're going to trim your apple tree and not in the way you want. So, you know, make sure your location, obviously, with trees is the most important thing. Tree size also isn't just dependent on rootstock, but also location, shading. I mean, whether it has to reach for light, watering, soil. All those are controlling factors too, just like any other tree.
If someone has, is the, you know, they've got their house, and is there a best direction, like on the side of the house, to plant an apple tree?
I wouldn't say that, but you got to keep in mind that apple trees, to be productive, need a good amount of light.
Okay.
I mean, these are not shade trees by any means. If you have a fair bit of shade underneath it, they won't produce any apples, actually. Yeah. And I've seen that in our orchard. The ones that are near the tree line, we almost get nothing out of. And so, you know, just like a garden or anything else, full sun is important.
Sure.
So, you know, there are some fruits that do better with shade, but not apples isn't one of them. So, you know, obviously location is important. But the fun part is deciding what types of top that you want on that tree. Basically, what type of apple that you want. So K-State has recommendations on what do good around here. And there's different varieties. They have different harvest times. And so from June all the way to October. I mean, there are some apples that ripen almost right before the frost. And so, I mean, you have a lot of variation there. What type of tree that you want and all that. And don't. You know, you should probably do more than one. Mostly because some of them actually need cross-pollination. So you can't just have one variety. Some are self-fruitful, but a lot of them aren't. So, you know, my suggestion is, though, give that tree more room than what the recommendations say. From experience, I know spraying fruit trees is difficult, especially when they're all crunched together. A semi-dwarf apple tree can produce up to 8 bushels of apples.
Wow.
If you manage it well, you take care of it, 8 bushels of apples is like 400 pounds. No one can possibly use 400 pounds of apples.
That's a lot of pie.
So if you have 3 or 4 apple trees, you have more than enough apples than you will ever deal with. You're going to be giving them away. The rest of them are going to rot. So that's plenty of apple trees. But if you have a dozen trees that are really crowded together and they're struggling, fighting each other, you're going to end up with less than that. I mean, you're going to end up with less than a bushel of apples. So, I mean, you know, it's better to have fewer that you take care of than to buy a whole bunch. And it's very difficult to cut down a tree. So, because, you know, you get attached to them. So, you know, just plan. Just buy just a couple, basically, apple trees, if you know what you're doing. And get a couple that are different from each other. So, a lot of the stuff I'm saying, actually, is very similar to pears, too. They do a lot of the same things. It's not the same family, but they're similar genetically. So the pears, and the tops and the bottoms are different. I was reading last night something odd. All of our, basically the Bradford pears, the calorie pears that are all over the place, and now it's almost become like an invasive species.
Yes, yes, they're really bad in South Central Kansas.
Yes, they're all over the place. We could actually graft edible pears onto those things.
Awesome.
I did not know that.
That's fantastic.
But apparently it's a thing in some places in the country where they're like, you know, guerrilla gardening. They go along and they actually, it's an Asian pear.
Yeah.
And so calorie pears are Asian pears, and you can graft pears onto those pears. We can do the same thing with our crab apples, like graft edible apples onto our crab apples, but that's less of an issue. So all those wild pears out there, and now we can actually do something with them.
We need to do, come into the dark of night and grafting.
Yeah, go down grafting.
Yeah, because those Bradford pears, the problem is people don't trim them, and, you know, they get way too big, and then you got huge limbs, you know, coming off
left
and right.
Yes, and Bradford pears are very bad with breaking all over the place, and people, you know, cut them off and let them regrow and all that.
And then for a couple weeks in like April or May, it just smells terrible.
Yes. So, you know, all those pear trees, I mean, some of those won't graft as easy as others because it kind of depends on the previous genetics of those pear trees. But for the most part, really, it's not actually an issue. And so, you know, when you're grafting these pears, it's I don't know, it's better to not get a massive tree. I think there's different ways that you graft depending on the size of that tree and all that. So I'm planning on doing this around my yard. I have a whole bunch of pear trees. Some of them are in the right locations and some of them are not. And so I'm going to try to graft some of these that I don't really care about.
Right. You know, because I almost thought I even saw someone, they had a tree that was like a combination pear apple.
Yes.
Yeah, this sort of thing. And that's, I was in the catalog. I was like, wow, that's wild.
Yeah. Actually, oddly enough, that you can sometimes, it's harder, it's less successful, but you can graft an apple tree onto a pear stock. So those Bradford pears, you can actually put an apple tree on them instead.
Like Frankenstein.
Yeah. That's beyond my capabilities. But apparently grafting pears onto a Bradford pear is not that hard. Mm. And pear trees are a little bit easier to take care of than apple trees. So,
interesting. Okay.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah, no, very cool. Well, this is just, it's been a great topic.
Yeah, it's been fun.
I always love, fruit trees always kind of fascinate me. So next time we need to do like citrus. That's a whole nother thing.
Man.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's another level.
Yeah it is. I've seen some people in Kansas here try to do it, and they got to have those smudge pots or whatever they are. The ones to heat the air a little bit if you have freezing temperatures.
Yeah,
they've got all this stuff to try to keep the, you can only do about 1 degree difference with those.
Yeah,
it's wild stuff. All right. Well, James or Wendy, if people have questions about any of the topics we've talked about, how can they get a hold of you guys?
Call any of the Wildcat Extension offices. Wendy just said the one for Altamont. One for Girard is 620-724-8233.
Yep, and that Altamont office number again is 620-784-5337.
All right. Well, I always learn so much on Wednesdays. It's great. So good to have you all on, and I look forward to next time.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, and we'll be back with more right after this on KGGF.